call Senate State Affairs. Order, it's about 6 minutes after the hour and on April Fool's Day. It's not a comment on the either the panelists or the audience. And present we have Senator Kiesel, Senator Witkowski, and Senator Coghill, and myself, Chair Dyson. Today we have one item on the agenda. It's Senate Bill 30, Teachers and Public Employees Retirement Plans. The sponsor is Senator Egan. We heard this last week, and my hope that we can hear all the public testimony today. We will not be passing the bill out today, and we'll any further action on it, we'll try to have that up and posted at least a couple of days before it happens. So, who would like to speak to us first? Do we have a list? Anyways, we'll take beauty and wisdom first.
You say the nicest things.
I'm pandering, but it's all true. Oh, and assisting us today, Chris on records, and Shane. Have you been with us before, Shane?
Yeah.
Okay, well, forgive me for forgetting. And Brock and Aaron doing gavel to gavel. It is my conviction you may have the most boring job I've ever known of. All right, please identify yourself for the record.
I am, first of all, good morning to all of you. And I am Liz Lucas, the Executive Director of the Alaska State Retired Educators Association. We represent 1,000-plus members. And our members are committed to improving the quality of life for Alaska's educators. And we support education for all ages. And we continue to make a difference in our communities by providing leadership and service. I am here today just to simply make a statement strongly supporting Senator Egan and Senate Bill 30. We were all here in the room last Thursday when the Senate bill was ably presented by Senator Egan and by Jesse, followed by a rather well-researched power presentation. We know the facts, all of us, and the figures surrounding the data that is stated in the bill. The questions were asked, and they were answered by those close to the bill. Time is of the essence, and I respectfully suggest that we agree to support Senator Egan's Senate Bill 30. And I thank you very much for this time to express our feelings from AKREA. Thank you.
And please, don't leave. If everyone is testifying, if you have written testimony, if you'll my staff, I will get it distributed as Joshua, and or you can email it to us. Are there questions for Liz? Okay, thank you. Next I have on is Jesse. You just here for questions? All right. And also, let's see, off-net, Andy Holman. Can you hear us, Andy?
Yes, I can hear you.
Please choke up on the mic there and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Andy Holloman. I'm the president of the Anchorage Education Association in Anchorage, representing about 3,300 people. I'm here to speak in favor of SB 30. I think it's worth remembering how the whole defined benefit system came about. It started as a way to bring significant value to employees. employees over a long period of time at a reasonable cost to the employer. If it was a case that you can invest this money slowly, so to speak, as an employee serves, and build something that's of great value to them without simply putting it into a high salary or some other form of attracting them. We do believe that experienced educators that want to make a life in Alaska are what we want to attract here. We think it's good for our kids. We think it's good for our schools. And the employment conditions ought to reflect that we are trying to attract experienced and top quality people. And I'll admit that when people first come into the profession, retirement is simply not on their mind. And I recall as I was sitting to take a test to get my Alaska certification, this was about 20 years ago, the person proctoring it took some time to talk about how great it was to retire in Alaska as an educator. And I didn't want to hear any of it. I wanted to take the test. I wanted to get my certificate. I wanted to get a job teaching. And the details of retirement at that time could not have mattered less to me. And I think that's part of the reason you haven't gotten a huge outcry out of the general population or out of employees across the state. I know you've gotten some, but it hasn't been enormous. The reality is younger employees are focused on their jobs. And we've had the defined contribution system now in place for about 7 or 8 years. In that time, people have changed their lifestyle a little bit. A lot of them have gotten married. They've started to have kids. They've started to think long-term. They've started to look at the financial implications of making a career in Alaska. And it's coming up very short. As Mr. Fornia said the last time you were holding testimony, Alaska uniquely stands out as a major employer, not just among the states, but as any employer in this country that doesn't allow participation in Social Security or offer a defined benefit retirement plan. Your employees, once they do the math, realize they end their careers with a pile of cash, which is a great thing. It's going to last for some period of time, but if they outlive their projection or if they have some calamity that takes an enormous amount of money to get through, they're left in a situation where they truly are out of money and they have no income coming in. They're destitute in their 70s or 80s and really have no resources to help themselves at that point. When they realize that that's their possible future in Alaska and they have an alternative of working in a different state where they don't have to face that prospect, they'll move, and I have friends that have done it. There are always multiple reasons for people to choose to move to another state, but I can tell you that for people that are a number of years into the profession, this is very much on their mind. It's a huge negative for retaining teachers in Alaska, and I want us to be in a position I want Alaska to be able to choose who they retain. I don't want us to be left with the people that will just stay here regardless. I want us to be able to pick good educators to be in the classroom. So I do hope that we'll realize that we're last in the nation on this, and it's time to do something. Thank you.
Questions for Andy? Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just clarification. I believe, Mr. Holloman, I heard you say that Alaska doesn't allow teachers to participate in Social Security. I just wanted to clarify that because it's my understanding that actually that was a federal government decision back in the 30s. Did I mishear you?
I'll be honest. I haven't ever gotten a good history of this. I don't know how it could be a decision from the 30s prior to us being a state, prior to us having the system. My understanding is it was a decision made in the 60s. Relative to the state providing its own retirement system, and it, that the state opted out at that time. And it is the case that I'm someone that chose education as a second career. I have about 20 years of payments into the Social Security system, and the benefits that I'm going to receive are diminished, in particular any survivor benefits for my family are erased by the fact that I'm in the state of Alaska retirement system. Now, I'm in Tier 2, so I have something that balances that. But No, my understanding is the state opted out, and the situation was they would provide an adequate retirement in place of.
Senator Geisel, to continue.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that point, I did ask Mr. Barnhill, and I believe he said in public testimony, and this is just to clarify for the public, that actually it when Social Security was instituted in the U.S., teachers were exempted from it. Our public employees did vote back, I believe, in the 60s, if I'm recalling his testimony correctly, to opt out of Social Security. It was not state government that made either of those decisions. But I will confirm that with Mr. Barnhill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I've been asking the same question, and my memory is pretty close to yours, but also that the state then had the supplemental benefits system, SBS, that was supposed to be comparable, similar contribution, and hopefully similar results. But maybe we can get that confirmed. Are you Kathy? I thought you looked like Kathy. And we'll have Kathy help us here on that. Andy, I was really impressed the last time we heard this bill by a young teacher from perhaps me in my district, I think his last name is Barra, who had some very impressive and discouraging statistics about the turnover we've had with employees in the Tier 4 system. Did you hear that, sir?
Jacob's one of my members, and I'm familiar with those statistics, and I'm very familiar with Jacob as well. And he's kind of a classic case. Both he and his wife are educators. They're both outstanding. They're outstanding educators. They're outstanding people. And I think they got here just under the wire in terms of being part of TERS 2. But, you know, I have since seen similar couples. A good friend of mine who's an outstanding math teacher who spoke to you several years ago on this, his wife was a very good science teacher in my school at Golden View. They live in New Mexico now. And part of it's family, but part of it's the fact that as they began to start a family and look long term, the question was how do you arrive at a point where you can support your kids and have a confirmed, solid future to the degree you can. And if I can throw in just one more aspect, I'll admit I didn't fully understand what retirement meant until my wife retired. And you're faced with some questions. One of them is, do you take survivor benefits on her retirement policy? And there's no way to know the right answer to that question. What's really being asked is which one of us is going to die first, and we don't know. But the reality is, with her being a Tier 1, me being a Tier 2, we've paid for our house, we have money in the bank, we've made a lot of right decisions. We might make the wrong call, but we're going to be okay, and that's what a defined benefit does for you to some degree. It doesn't guarantee the best in life. It basically guarantees that you're always going to have some resources to work with. Our current system just does not. And when people think about their old age and think about providing for their kids and realizing they could be facing that, having been out of the workforce, having not having current skills anymore, and having no financial resources, you don't want to stay and watch that situation develop.
Yeah.
Yes, Jacob's still here, and I think he's going to make a career here because he can see his future all the way through the end.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate him. You gave me more answer than I wanted, but thank you. One of the philosophical questions for me, under the present Tier 4, as I understand it, there is portability so that your retirement benefits can go with you wherever you move. And is under the option that's before us, the portability is gone. Is that your understanding?
Looking at the details, what usually happens in a defined benefit is that if you leave early, you get your contributions back, and you may get some interest on those contributions. So you still do have some savings, and a lot of times people use that money to buy into other systems in other states. I'm thinking particularly about teachers in that case. But it's not as if you're sitting there with about 10 years in, the option to move is not as financially enticing as the option to stay. And I think that's what gets created. It's not that there's no portability. Sometimes people move for other reasons and they have no control over it. It's not that they leave all their money behind.
Yeah, I got it. All right. And maybe it's the libertarian in me, but I really have a philosophical problem with us structuring our benefits system so it kind of has a tendency to force people to stay here against their will. And buying loyalty is an issue for me. I want people in Alaska who love it, they're going to stay come hell or high water, and are committed. But thank you. And one of the things that Mr. Barra made very clear to me is that if indeed his figures were correct, then we are losing people and maybe the young and bright teachers that we want to keep because of the benefit program and compensation not being sufficient, which is always a signal to a manager that you need to change something. Thank you. Can you stand by?
Yes, I will.
All right. Kathy, please identify yourself for the record and help us out.
Hey, for the record, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the Chief Pension Officer of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And Senator Geisel, through the chair, in answer to your question, the territory of Alaska has provided a teacher's retirement system since 1947. In 1955, the state of Alaska had an opportunity to join Social Security. The requirements at that time was they could opt in all employees who were not covered by a retirement system, and they could also choose to opt in those who were already covered by a retirement system. So since the teacher's retirement system was already in place, the state of Alaska opted, well, excuse me, the territory of Alaska opted to cover only those employees who did not have another retirement system. And the public employees retirement system did not come into being until 1960. So the territory employees and state of Alaska, later state of Alaska employees, did participate in Social Security up until February 1980. The employees held a referendum in 1979 when there was an opportunity to go with a Social Security replacement plan. And so the state of Alaska employees and 16 other participating municipalities have been in the Alaska Supplemental Annuity Plan since February of 1980.
Kathy, so the public employees, made a choice. Refresh again for me what you said about the teachers.
The teachers were provided with a retirement system since 1947. So the teachers did not vote to go into Social Security or not. The Territory of Alaska made that decision in their Social Security agreement in 1955. And we do have a copy of that agreement if you would like to see it.
And what did the feds tell us we could do or not do? Were we constrained in any way by federal law?
Chair Dyson, the feds gave us a choice of including in Social Security all employees who were not otherwise covered by a retirement system. We could also include those who were, but the territory chose not to.
Okay. All right, thank you. Please continue.
that was the sum total of what I had to say, unless you have additional
questions. For Kathy, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about, under the current system, Tier 4 PERS, I guess Tier 3 TERS, is there some sort of vesting in that system?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, under PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3, there is a vesting system. It's to vest into the employer contributions that are made to your account. So it's a staggered vesting, which after 2 years, you're 25% vested, 50%, 75%, and then fully vested in the employer contributions with 5 years of service. But the member does have the opportunity to choose the investment options for the employer contributions from the date they receive them. That is the same vesting schedule for the teachers as well.
And then, so I understand, you start working at a public school. The employer's contributing along with the employee, but after two, you don't get that employer contribution until you stay there for 2 years, and you get 25%. And then, the longer you stay, the more of the employer contributions you get. Is that how it works?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's how it works.
Okay. And then, can you just talk about portability under the old Tier 2 TERS and Tier 3 PERS systems? Is if you leave before your five-year vesting, are you able to cash out the contributions that you've made?
Through the chair, yes, you are able under the defined benefit system to cash out your contributions at termination, regardless of whether you're vested or not. We do have employees with considerable years of service who cash out. The contributions earn 4% interest that's compounded semi-annually. So when a defined benefit member chooses to refund their contributions, they only can take the contributions they've made plus any interest it's earned. The employer contributions revert back to the employer.
Do you have any data on employees now? Are they under Tier 4 PERS, Tier 3 TERS? Are you seeing large numbers of people leave their jobs, leave the system after their vesting?
Through the chair, we just completed a query for Senator Giesel's office on the retention schedule, comparing the defined benefit retention against the defined contribution retention, and we have provided that just shortly before this meeting. We'd be happy to provide it to all of you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Kathy, really appreciate your expertise and experience. So I'm irritated by an inadvertent phenomenon we have where most of the bargaining units, the picking of jobs, in a sense, goes on a seniority basis. And friends of mine in the bush, and all my experience in the bush is Western Alaska, will choose to get themselves a rural assignment in an area that has a significant cost of living differential for, I think it's 3 years, maybe used to be three and is now more. And local people have said, you know, here these very nice experienced teachers come, camp out for 9 months, gone quite a few of the weekends, every long holiday and so on and so forth, and the kids get the message. These folks, you know, are good during the day and during the week, but they don't really care about us, you know, and they're kind of a temporary assignment, TDY, if you will. And the villager leadership complains that they don't have people who are committed to the community, come there and live, and really care about the kids on a long-term situation. But the incentive is there for the bill those 3 years because it profoundly or significantly affects the retirement. Now, I have enough training to know that the plural of antidote isn't data, you know, and so on. Give me your perception.
Chair Dyson, I think the necessity of bush areas to have to pay higher salaries to attract folks works both in the defined benefit and the defined contribution plan systems. in the defined benefit systems for the PERS only, there is a restriction of using any what we call geographic differential in the calculation of your retirement. It has to be half of your service served in an area with a differential before it can be used. In the teacher's retirement, there's no restriction on any type of differential because that's simply the pay for that area. So in the defined benefit plan, if a teacher serves 3 years in an area with a high salary, their retirement will be calculated on that salary, on the average of those 3 years. In the defined contribution plan, it is very attractive to work in an area with a higher salary because that means higher contributions into your account, higher employer contributions as well. And since the defined contribution benefit is based on the contribution balance, then it is attractive to work in the bush areas. So we see those large salaries working to attract both defined benefit and defined contribution employees.
Thank you. That's a very useful piece of information. So we get the incentives doing kind of what we want it to do. So the Tier 4 folks have that advantage. They get it right?
Chair Dyson, yes, they do, because the higher their salary, the more their contributions are going into their accounts.
And they also have the advantage of more complete portability.
Chair Dyson, that's true, because once they have 2 years, they can start accessing the employer contributions. And once they have 5 years of service, they're 100% vested in the employer contributions. Yep. So they can take it all and to whatever position they choose to go to.
Right.
And that is different from defined benefit.
So I sat in a seminar, I think, here a couple of weeks ago talking about this. And as I understand it, almost all retirement systems are designed and operate on the assumption that the money in the account will earn enough to pay the demand on it for the retired folks. And certainly a part of the state of Alaska's problem is that the investments didn't grow and pay them, earn the dividends that the assumptions. So as I understand it, what we have before us today is assuming 8% return on investment, is that correct?
Senator Dyson, yes. For the defined benefit plans, we assume 8% return.
And the one we have before us, an SB 30, assumes 8%?
I believe so, yes.
Jesse's
nodding,
for the record. All right. So that's a concern for all of us, I think. Certainly recent history doesn't reflect that. If we ask you to run the calculations on what it would be at, say, 4, 6, and 8%, are you equipped to be able to do that? Would that be laborious?
Yes, sir. We could do that for you.
My question was, does it take a lot of effort?
No, we already have a spreadsheet already developed to do that.
Yeah, I would like that. I don't know how to ask the question that I want the answer to, but I think you do. So what we want to, this bill that we have before us has evolved and has been carefully crafted, and it is designed, I think, to not expose the people of Alaska to new risk, you know, for unfunded liabilities, and to be pay-as-you-go, and to be able to adjust if the assumptions change. But anyways, I would appreciate it if you would do that. If you get it to Joshua, we'll get it to the committee members. How long would it take you to do that?
It would probably take us maybe 3 days to get it completed. I'd like to clarify one part of the request, though. Do you just want balances, or do you want to see, with that balance, what are the options for disbursement? Because there are 8 options for disbursement, one of which is a lifetime annuity.
I'm pausing and blinking because I never even thought about that. I assume that the disbursements, the total amount going out isn't different, but how it's spaced and paced, it would be different, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so committee members, help me out here. What kind of information would you like to see to help us understand this? Senator Wilkowski.
I'd like to I know there's been a lot of talk about this 8%, whether or not that's an accurate number or not. I'd be curious what the historical average of the S&P 500 index was for the last, since, say, 1926.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not sure we can go back until 1926 in
Actually,
3 days.
Can.
But we
you
can
just Google it.
Okay.
I can tell you what it is. It's 9.77%. But I'd be curious to hear what, you know, if you come up back with a different number. And I'd be curious to know what number the administration uses in calculating the returns and what the ARM board uses also, what their recommended numbers are.
Okay.
Fate, can you join us? Fate has been around here darn near as long as I have and has a lot of credibility with me. You can understand the question I'm trying to ask. Mm-hmm. Help me out. How should we ask the question? And could you all make the same kind of calculation or at least help us check the veracity of the information we get?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fate Putman, for the record, representing ASCA. Yeah, we do actually have an actuary. He was here last time. He's online listening, and I've been texting him, asking him that same question, so hopefully he could provide you with that information.
Yeah. Who is it?
Flick Fornia.
Rick, can you hear us?
Flick.
Sorry?
Flick. His name is Flick.
Flick?
Yeah. Flick. William is his actual given name.
William, can you hear us? He's not on. Anyways, please. Now, how better should we be asking the question of Kathy?
I think what you're asking is correct. What is the long-term projections for growth with our investments? As Senator Wilkowski pointed out, it's been historically 9.7. We built this bill so that it's only 8% as an estimate, less than a 9.7, in anticipation that the growth will exceed our expectations. That makes sense.
I'm glad you're not my investment counselor.
I'm not an investment.
Senator Coghill.
I know that retirement systems have to look at the long term, and so going back that far is probably appropriate. But it's also true that we've gone through probably since I've been working in the workforce in the 70s, I think we've gone through five major recessions, and certainly the one that got our retirement system the worst was in the late 1990s, early 2000. That really got us. 2008 was kind of the bottom of the barrel, right? So even though we have probably a long-term look, there are some pretty significant market corrections. And so when we look at that, both on disbursement levels and on income levels, we should probably have two trend lines that follow those. So I think we have to look at those as in context. Anyway, just Mr. Chairman, if that's a right way to look at it.
Senator Giesel.
I would just add to that. Kathy's question was, did we want to see the various disbursements? And I would suggest we do. I did ask this question of Deputy Commissioner Barnhill last fall, and I do have a chart of some of the information, but it's not broken out in detail. It actually comes from the division. So I think we would benefit from having some detail, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you bet. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, and just following up on Senator Coghill's point, which is a good one, can you break it down? I think it would be helpful for us if you broke down the returns, say, 15-year, 20-year, 25-year, what the returns were over those 25. Because the historic average of the S&P is 9.77%. But you can go back to 77, for instance, and the 25-year average annual return is 9.19%. 78 is 9.5%. You can go, I mean, you can look at any 25-year period and you're not going to see a return of less than 8%. So, but it'd be helpful for you to produce that. If you've got different figures, let's see them. Historically, the 8%, I think, is a very reasonable number. I know that you have down years, but it averages out over time. At least historically, it has.
Senator Coghill.
And the reason I ask for the trend lines is when we watched the permanent fund, we had the same question come up. We saw these returns, and historically, you can follow those, but we also lost billions of dollars, and it took those years to make that up. And so that's why I think you need to have those two trend lines, because, for example, I think in 2002-03, somewhere in that neighborhood, we offered early retirement system, which created a big disbursement issue. And then we went back and rehired many of the retired teachers, which creates another disbursement issue. So I think that's why you have to have those trend lines to show, as people retire, when are the biggest retirement hits, and do they hit at the same time market hits? We need to really see that, because you can have a trend line that shows continuous growth, but every once in a while you bottom out, and it takes a long time to regain that. I mean, we hit $40 billion in the permanent fund just recently. Well, we hit that a few years ago, too, and then we lost $10 billion. So, you know, just on, I know that the TERS trust fund and the PERS trust fund also took some pretty significant hits, and so did some of our Tier 4 people, quite frankly. I mean, when they went out into the market was flat and going down, and so... And I'm very sympathetic to that. Felt the pain myself. But I think those trend lines will help us to see, you know, what our outgo was and what our income was and where those lines crisscross.
Senator Giesel. Well, I'm sorry.
I just want to make one point on that.
Identify yourself. Yeah.
Fate Putman again with ASCA. What we've designed or the senators designed in this legislation is an ability to offset that increase. If, in fact, you don't reach the 8% and it's less than that, we know the health care cost is the component that really drives the retirement system. So what the bill is designed to do is shifting the cost to the employee of the increasing health care cost that isn't covered by investment growth. So that's basically how it works.
Senator Coghill.
And it would be an interesting question, probably a legal question, that I would probably pose is having put a risk component on the person who's receiving the benefit, we have a constitutional issue on diminishment of benefits. Mm-hmm. And it would be interesting to know you could always go up, could you never go back? And it would be interesting legal question to know if we've put ourselves in a little bit of a pickle with this type of a situation. Anyway, just ask them a legal question on that.
Joshua, I would appreciate it if you would frame that question and send it to Ledge Research, because it is a constitutional question. My understanding is all retirement benefits are contract law, and there is no basis on which the employer, the sovereign, conduct that. And so I think it's a valid question.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, I think probably it's legal. It's just something we probably better cover as we're going through the way.
Yes, Senator Giesel, do you have another question?
I just wanted to follow up on Senator Coghill's discussion of the return on investment over the past few years. I know that David Teal, who's a member of Legislative Finance, he's the head guy, has been studying this for a long time. I've heard him speak on it. I think it would be interesting to hear from him, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. William has signed back on. We'll talk to him here in a minute. Kathy, if and when this bill passes, do the contributions from the employer and stuff start going into a separate bucket, a separate account?
Chair Dyson, if this bill passes and employees make the election to go into the defined benefit plan, their contributions will go into defined benefit accounts. So, yes, it will go into a different bucket than what they're currently going into now. And that will be the employee contribution with the employers not mixed in with it.
But the employee contribution is committed to doing that, and it's like almost like being in escrow. Is that a different bucket than what the other defined benefit employees money is in?
Chair Dyson, it would not be, because it would be back in the defined benefit trust.
Okay, so you can see what I'm getting at. When we want, I want a spreadsheet, and I'd like a graph that shows for this new group of employees, their contribution plus their employees' contribution, juxtaposed with the cost to that, you know, people retiring and getting benefits, discrete from the big bucket that's got all of the defined benefit employees. I realize it's just an accounting function. So did I make that clear?
Yes, sir, and we do account for the funds within the PERS trust by tier.
Yeah, so the way I'm wired, I really like pictures. So if we had a graph that would show the growth of the account and the anticipated growth of the account and the anticipated growth of the demand on it, you know, juxtaposed, that would be helpful. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what amount of the unfunded liability is caused by the defined benefit and what is caused by the health care?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I have not recently looked at the valuation, so I cannot give you an accurate answer on that. I can certainly get that for you.
Do you know generally?
Generally, I would say it's the health care side.
Is the vast majority of the unfunded liability, or do you have a sense?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I wouldn't say it was the vast majority.
I'd like to see the numbers if you could get those. Thank you.
Can get those for you, yes.
Yeah, excellent question. I'm a bad example of showing how the old folks are demanding on the system. All right. We had the option and had planned on having David Teal here to testify, but I chose not to, pending getting this information. So, any other questions or comments from the committee? Okay, thanks to both of you. Jesse? Yeah, you've heard the discussion. Are there any comments you would like to make on behalf of the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. I appreciate the opportunity to wrap up a little and respond to some of the thoughts and questions that the committee posed. It's been an intriguing discussion. In response, maybe in order to a couple of things, your concerns about how the pension benefit is calculated is something that can be addressed through plan design. You mentioned the average 5 highest year salary for the public employees tier 3. That was designed as a provision to reduce or eliminate pension spiking, late career moves to spike up the pension amount. And certainly there are plans that go further than that, some that use lifetime average earnings in covered positions. And so stability in the pension system can be enhanced through plan design. And the sponsor would be happy to work with you on that.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Just on that point, but aren't those bargainable? I mean, don't those get bargained in the union contracts? My friend Tom says no.
Oh, to be clear, Mr. Chairman, the things like the geographic differentials you're describing, I believe, are bargained with unions. How the pension benefit is calculated is not bargained, and in fact, Alaska's Public Employee Relations Act, I believe, is explicit that pension benefits are not subject
all right.
to bargaining.
Pardon the interruption.
Not at all. Thank you. There was also some discussion of the history of Alaska teachers and Social Security. I don't have much to add. Alaska is one of the 14 states that does not include teachers in Social Security. 36 others elected to do that in their Social Security agreements with the federal government. There was a great deal of discussion of portability, and I appreciated Ms. Lee's context that employees who decide to leave the defined benefit system, whether before or after they vest, are entitled to take all the money that they contributed plus a 4% guaranteed rate of return, which if you left late in 2009 would mean you beat the market substantially. I think it's also important to note another element of plan design that is very deliberate on Alaska's part and is important to Senator Egan. The defined benefit pensions in Senate Bill 30, like the legacy systems that Alaska has, have a 10% cost of living adjustment for those retirees who live in Alaska. It is designed quite deliberately to keep retirees living here in our state, living in homes here, paying plumbers and roofers to repair those homes and shopping in our grocery stores and getting their cars fixed. It works. 70% of PERS and TERS defined benefit retirees retire and live in Alaska. 90% of the benefits, the cash benefits, the pension checks, go to Alaska residents. Just running from the fiscal year 11 valuation, Mr. Chairman, $921 million between PERS and TERS both in FY11 were paid into Alaska's economy. And I am not an economist, but the National Institute for Retirement Research says the total economic impact to Alaska of that, I guess, $815 million, 90% of 920, has an economic impact of more than $1.4 billion in our state's economy. So I will leave you with that economic note, unless the committee has further questions. I thank you again for your consideration of the bill.
Yeah. Questions for Jesse? Hang on there, please. William Flick, was it? Fornia, can you hear us, William? Did we lose him? Sure.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear. Thanks for helping us.
Thank you so much.
Please identify yourself and give us your input here on these issues we're discussing.
Yeah, my name's William Fornia. I go by Flick, as I understand you were just discussing. I'm a consultant with Pension Trustee Advisors working for the Alaska Public Pension Coalition. It's nice to talk to you and see you all again. I have been listening in the entire session. And would you like to ask me specific questions? Do you want me to respond to some of the questions I heard you have?
Yeah. Why don't you respond to the questions you heard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The main question that I was intrigued about was your concern about if returns are only, I think you said, 4 and 6% or 2, 4, and 6%, what would that do to the pension funds? And you know, the actuary for the pension system can calculate it, but the numbers would be horrendous. The cost, if you had continuous returns of only 6% or worse, only 4%, you can be sure that there would be big problems, not only for this new tier, but more importantly for the prior tier. But I think it's important to remember that at the same time, if the individual accounts were continued under the current approach, you know, the benefits that we would be able to collect as a retiree would be equally problematic. You might recall from my testimony last week that the benefits that we project under the new tier are, you know, about 20% of pay less than the proposed benefits under the new tier, under the new defined benefit tier. You know, those numbers would even be more extreme if indeed we had long-run investment returns in that 4 and 6% range. So I caution you to only, I think it's a little biased to only look at one alternative of low returns without looking at the other consequence of low returns. And then I believe Senator Geisel had a question about contract law and whether benefits can be reduced. It really depends on how the contracts are written. If the benefit is up front, you know, in advance, described as possibly reducing, then there's no problem. Now, let me caveat that I'm not a lawyer, but I've worked on a lot of these cases. If the benefit up front is described as possibly able to be reduced, then there's no contract problem. The state of Wisconsin, for example, does that with their cost of living adjustment. They have one that's variable depending upon returns. There are other states that do similar benefit provisions. I'm happy to take any other specific questions, but that was my response to what I heard a few minutes ago.
Questions for Flick? I appreciate you helping us out. This Alaska Public Pension Coalition, who are the members of the coalition, Flick?
There's a collection of the unions, NEA, AFL, police and firefighters. I think Jesse and Fate would be able to describe them more accurately.
Yeah, okay, I appreciate that. And are you an independent contractor? Do you work for lots of different...
I am, but I work very hard to work both sides of this issue. For example, I'm working on the Detroit and Stockton bankruptcy in favor of the creditors. I've worked with unions in some other states. I'm an expert witness on the Baltimore lawsuit where the police and firefighters are suing my client, the city, for having cut benefits. So, I work very hard not to be slotted on only one side of this issue. But, yes, I'm independent.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You just made a valid point that I didn't think about, and that is, if I heard you correctly, if we were to adopt the system that is before us here, the risk to the state, if indeed investment performance goes down, the risk to the state would be less under this bill that's before us than under the current Tier 4 system. Is that correct?
Not quite. No, because the state would be, you know, guaranteeing the benefits, the risk is, the investment risk is greater to the estate. Under the current proposal, if we have bad returns, the risk would be more secondary. You know, you'd have individuals that aren't able to retire, so you'd have, you know, labor problems, and the ones that had retired would have lower benefits, so you might have other kind of public assistance problems. But, you know, the fact is that the traditional defined benefit plans do, in general, they don't have to work this way, but in general, they place more of the risk on the employers than on the employees. Now, the biggest risk you'd have is your old tiers. You know, you've still got a large unfunded liability with tier 1, 2, and 3. In PERS 3, rather, that would be a disaster under this low investment return scenario. It's not pretty, but that would be a much bigger problem than adding this new tier.
All right. Any questions for Flick? Senator Wilkowski?
Hey, Flick, can you just talk for a minute about how much of the unfunded liability healthcare makes up, and under this, I think there, and just about the whole issue of tying in healthcare with pensions, and where's the real risk? I mean, is it with the healthcare, or is it with the pensions, or defined benefit?
Senator, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure. I used to be the actuary for the ARM board also, and I'm not certain that they even allocate the unfunded liability between the two components of the plans. So it might be a relatively difficult question to ask. I do know that, you know, when you read in the national press anything that's suggesting Alaska has an unfunded liability problem that's outsized, so to speak, what the press tends to forget is that unlike almost every other state in the union, you are pre-funding your retiree health care. Most states, you know, with the exception of Alaska and Ohio and a couple others, do not pre-fund their retiree health care at all. So they've got a much larger unfunded liability. In your case, you know, I would say certainly a substantial amount of the unfunded liability is due to health care. And by that I mean, you know, increased health care costs as opposed to inadequate investment return. But this bill is designed to try to fix the health care side of it. You know, the increased health care cost is baked into this bill that if those costs go up too much, that's going to shift that cost back onto the employees. You haven't done anything on that on the investment return side, but a huge chunk of the risk that the state is taking in the form of health care costs is being pushed back to the pool of employees.
Further questions for Flick? I hear and read, Flick, this is Dyson, that many other sovereigns, states, municipalities, counties, are considering going to a defined contribution system going forward. Is there any trend that you're seeing?
Mr. Chairman, I think I want to push back on that a little bit. There are certainly concerns and hybrid-type arrangements that are being considered, but there haven't been any new defined contribution plans. There are some cities here and there that are considering it, but even like a Detroit that's in bankruptcy is just their new tier is going to be under the city's proposed plan of adjustment under their bankruptcy. Even that's going to be a defined benefit plan. It's going to be a lesser defined benefit plan, but it's still going to be a defined benefit plan. Ohio went through major changes. They chose not to switch to defined contribution. They just made some, cuts. Louisiana just went through some changes. They switched to a hybrid type plan, not a defined contribution plan. So I think that while, you know, we hear of some studies on that regard, I don't see it. And I'm involved in a great number of states and cities around the country. And at this point, there have been no new ones. There's been some studies, but that's about it.
All right, thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions for Flick? Any other questions from the committee to any of the folks that testified? Is there anybody that wants to testify that hasn't? Any other questions that we want to get answered before we entertain this issue again? All right, seeing and hearing, Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am going to ask the Department of Administration to break out the health care costs. As you know, this committee delved deeply into health care costs a couple years ago, and we did get a breakdown of the costs for the health care component. So I think that's a worthy question to have updated from the 2011 data we were given last year.
All right, so I'm going to ask Joshua, our very able committee aide, to make sure that we get everybody's questions and get them as definitive. And Kathy, to the degree you're able, I'd really like to see these things in graphs. If we can. And Fate, I don't want you to go to a huge amount of effort, but we really want to help us make sure we get credible information on what we're trying to figure out here. So we welcome that. All right, Senator Coghill.
So I probably the pool of people that would be eligible for this probably coming from new hires, the expected pool of people, and it was described to us that there's different venues, so if there's different benefit options, we probably better know what those are, so we should know the pool and the stream that they could flow in. And then I think that with that, we'd have to extrapolate what the benefit of pooling the money is to the state and to the employer employees, and then the risk, obviously, to the health care, how that could be expected under the options. You know, and I know that's a very complex question, but the way this is set up, it looks like it's going to end up in that kind of a complexity. So it looks like the benefit to the employee is the pooling capacity of the trust fund, and it looks like the health care risk is shared with the employee, and it looks to me like the benefit to the state might be retaining of people in the state, but the risk to the state is that they might have people they might have younger people not willing to promote because you have us older guys having to work longer because of health care issues. So did I quantify that right, Jesse?
Mr. Chairman, Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. I think you've hit on a number of important benefits to either side. I would argue that the health care cost risk falls almost entirely to the employee pool. There is another benefit to the state from the pooling of investments, and that is that a closed trust fund must gradually take less and less risk in its investments as the need for cash becomes more and more immediate. An open trust fund into which a new money is being put to cover future benefits can maintain an almost permanent time horizon, and thus, while our trust fund has never taken on the same risk as the S&P 500 index and thus not its returns, can maintain a much higher rate of return, I think since inception more than 8% in the PERS and TERS trusts. And so with an open trust fund with new benefits being accrued and paid for, we can continue to gain a tremendous portion of the economic benefit of pensions from essentially from the global economy instead of from Alaskan
state. That would open up another question, Mr. Chairman, and that is,
Cargill to continue.
With new money coming into the trust fund, would it be legally required to pay out only to the new tier, for example? And would that benefit never go to the unfunded liability? I mean, is there a risk-carrying mode there, or is there some kind of requirement that we'd have to fix in?
Mr. Chairman, in answering Senator Coghill's question, the bill as it's currently drafted puts the new defined benefit employees, their contributions and the employer's contributions for them go into the same trust. That was done for administrative efficiency, lower cost, et cetera. If we were to split them out into a separate trust fund, the legacy defined benefits trusts would have the same issue with their time horizon, and the unfunded liability exists. But to get the benefit of that open trust fund and the near permanent time horizon, we would need then to pool them, both assets and liabilities. We could account for them separately, but a trust fund is a trust fund.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and Jesse, please, you on behalf of the bill sponsor, anything you want to add to the information we're trying to get or make it straight and more integrity, please do.
Thank you, Mr.
But I think Senator Coghill just was raised an issue that I hadn't thought about, and that is if indeed this new tier went in the ditch financially, it could have a negative impact on the pool of money for folks in the other tiers. What are the circumstances in which, if this one didn't work, as anticipated, that it could be a draw on the same benefits pool to satisfy the draw from this, the employees in this new pool, which would be in the out years here.
Mr. Chairman, if we invest them together, then they would tend to move in tandem. If we were to invest them separately, then I think the same market forces and the same changes that might occur in the world, people living longer, a terrible pandemic, people living shorter, would affect both.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. My question was, if indeed any one of these tiers started having a very disproportionate draw on the bucket of money, would that pool of funds, the limits on it, could it negatively affect folks in the other tiers?
I will give that some thought, Mr. Chairman. My initial responses would be that any given tier of hires is made up of a variety of people of various ages, but I will certainly think further on whether I can come up with a worst case scenario for you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Well, as I understand it, one of the problems that we face now with the current tiers is that it's a closed system, as you mentioned. You have no new money coming in. You have to invest more conservatively. And so by opening this up and having younger public employees and all public employees who work contributing to the system, does that help alleviate some of our unfunded liability problem?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Wilkowski, I believe it does, especially in the out years, as the current defined benefit trusts must adjust downward their investment risk with a closed system and would be able to take a longer time horizon and gain greater returns with an open system.
Senator Coghill.
That could be speculation, the way I understand actuarials, but also could fall to be where we're at today. Anything under 8% we pick up. So, I think that is one of the risks that Jesse just spoke of. If it's under 8%, we just pick it up. And that's the way I understand it.
All right. All right. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Tom, I'll talk to you here when we get done. Tom is signaling to me that my question and my assumptions are wrong. We'll get it. All right. Anything else? All right. We're adjourned until Thursday. Thank you all.